Hello, I'm Rillian.
And this is Glumpuddle.
And we are reading The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
I won't tell you how I became a dragon till I can tell the others and get it all over, said Eustace. By the way, I didn't even know it was a dragon till I heard you all using the word when I turned up here the other morning. I want to tell you how I stopped being one. Far ahead, said Edmund.
The undragoning being told in retrospect, it just sort of, it takes the reader by kind of by surprise. It's like, wait a minute, Eustace is back. And you're kind of, did I miss something?
Right, yeah. Edmund, this is 6 days after they've landed on the island, mm-hmm. and Edmund wakes up early, which is a great character touch we'll talk about in a second. And, yeah, he sees someone coming. He doesn't know who it is. He's like, oh, it's too big to be Lucy. It's too small to be Caspian. And, you know, who are you? Don't you know? It's me, Eustace. And you're right. I think my first reaction was, wait a second. Did I skip a page or something? I like how Edmund can just see him as – Edmund recognizes him as being different. He says, you know – when Edmund asks Eustace about the arm ring and says Eustace laughed, a different laugh than any Edmund had ever heard him give. And it's so obvious that it wasn't just being a dragon, that he really has been changed.
Mm-hmm. And Eustace starts to explain how he saw a lion approaching him. And there's something, you know, again, this is one of the things I jotted down this morning. Yeah, I thought I've never thought of this phrase before, to the extent I do now. And Eustace is telling Edmund, "So it came nearer and nearer. I was terribly afraid of it. You may think that being a dragon, I could have knocked any lion out easily enough, but it wasn't that kind of fear. I wasn't afraid of it eating me. I was just afraid of it, if you can understand." Everyone can't help but be afraid, and yet they love him. They're not afraid of a vindictive kind of
anger.
He's
not safe, but he's good.
Yeah, he's not safe. It's like, yeah, he's not safe, but it's not a fear of any kind of anger or vindictiveness or evil. It's like a fear of him, not of what he's about to do to you.
Which is probably why Lewis chose the image of a lion, because lions are really beautiful, and you do almost want to imagine being able to pet one and hug one would be really amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and yet, they're so powerful. And so, yeah, that is one of the most interesting parts of this chapter, is the fact that he's not afraid of being eaten. He's just afraid of it, of the power he sees.
And I can say...
Their senses have, somehow.
Yeah, we have actually a zoo here nearby where I live, and it... I've never been able to see a lion as close as I was. I was maybe 10 feet from a grown male lion. And I remember I got as close to it as I could because there was a fence. But I can guarantee you if it had looked me in the eye and started roaring, or if it had jumped up on the fence. No, seriously, I can guarantee I would have been stepping back. It's that kind of – I thought – Now, of course, I wish I'd had it happen to me and had it on video, but seriously, I think that's partly why Lewis chose the image of a lion.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, I guess this might be something we'll talk about later, but even though this supposedly really happened and is not a dream, it has a very dreamlike quality to it. And one of the things, like, there's a lot, like, when you try to explain a dream to somebody, there are so many things that you have a hard time explaining even to yourself. Like, well, it doesn't make sense, but it happened, and during when I was in the dream, it made sense. It's things like, Eustace says, and I shut my eyes tight, but that wasn't any good because it told me to follow it. Edmund says, you mean it spoke? Eustace says, I don't know. Now that you mention it, I don't think it did, but it told me all the same. That's one of the things that, you know, in a dream, that might happen. How could something, someone speak to you without talking? It's like, I don't know, but it made sense to me. And there's a lot of things like that. Mm-hmm. In this, like, you know, the way Aslan's going to give him clothes at the end. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of things that you can't make. Certainly things you could not film.
Yeah, that's something I have to say. You know, I've thought about, like, how would I do this? And it's just, it would be so hard.
In the film, you mean?
Imagery. Yeah, if you were to present it on film, you know, where you're showing everything, you know. Unless you're to do some kind of weird abstract and you're making it vague. You know, but it works so well here.
It's
you
perfect
know?
For the book.
And I love
being able to get such hear uses his thoughts, how he's processing all this, what his perspective is, which is it's even better by he's actually telling the story. This isn't just we're not just in his head. We get to really get inside his head by hearing his version of it in retrospect.
He tells Eustace, "You must undress," and you know he knows that he has to get rid of all this ugliness, the scale. It has to come off, and then he tries and he tries and
tries
it just
three times.
It gets to the point where you're it's ridiculous to think, you know, how long could this really go on? You know, I mean, he's literally tearing his skin off, and it's not doing. It's not like he even sees it getting closer. You know, it's like, well, there's another one just like the one on top.
And that's important. He feels like he's making no progress at all. And that's why when Aslan says, "You'll have to let me undress you," that you know, Eustace is still incredibly afraid, but he's desperate. So the fact that he's, you know, and Eustace being probably still is a hint of pride in there. He needs to be given the chance to try it himself. And Aslan's like, okay. You tried three times and failed every time. It's obvious you can't do it.
I don't know if it's just – I don't know if it's that. I don't know if it's – well, he's probably has to be given the chance to try it himself. I think he has to be shown that he couldn't have done it himself.
Right. Oh, so you're looking at it more in the future. I think it's both. Aslan says, "You will have to let me undress you." Then Eustace says, "I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate by now." So it's after doing it three times, he's like, oh my gosh, he's sort of panicked. What am I going to do? He's really realizing he can't do it himself. Maybe if Aslan had just said, okay, I'm gonna do it now, maybe Eustace would have been too afraid.
Yeah.
That's the sense you get here, I think.
Well, and also, you know, you think about the timing, and if Aslan had come up in the 5 minutes after he'd become a dragon, he wouldn't have been desperate.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have been ready. He wouldn't have wanted it.
Maybe not. Having to go through that process three times and have it be, make no progress at all.
You know, and there's something that, and I just jotted this down because this was the second thing reading this, this last time. I don't know why I'd never thought of it this way before, but I just started looking at the parallels here. And I started looking at the differences between the dragoning and the undragoning. You know, how does Eustace become a dragon? Well, in the course of Narnian events, it's almost like it's to be expected, you know? It's like Lewis say, well, yes, Eustace was surprised because he never read the right books.
It does, like, he talks about it like it's inevitable.
Yeah, it's like this, for the world of Narnia, this is a natural
sleeping on a dragon's
hoard.
This is something evil, greedy dragonist thoughts in his heart, he became a dragon.
This is to be expected to happen. The undragoning is unexpected.
It's unnatural.
It's unnatural. It requires an intervention.
Yep.
And also, you think about the dragoning, it happens without Eustace even noticing it. It's something that happens. He doesn't even notice until after it's complete.
The process of becoming a dragon is swift and painless.
It's painless and it's easy. And when him is... In the undragoning, it is very painful.
Yeah, I want to read this bit here where Eustace says, where Aslan's undragoning him and says, "The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling this stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked the scab off a sore place, it hurts like bilio, but it is fun to see it coming away." And then I love how Edmund says, "I know exactly what you mean."
Yeah.
Edmund, of all people, would understand the painful process of being transformed, but also the satisfaction of it.
Yeah, and I think that's something that, you know, you can go out and find a lot of whatever you want. Books, movies, where there's some kind of a transformation. And they make it opposite. They make the descent into this horrible, icky place. They make that the painful part. Because maybe the author goes, well, okay, I can't relate. So that's the horrible part. And then the transformation, it's a breeze. But that's not how reality works. I love how Lewis portrays it here because he shows it as, yes, it's much more difficult and painful to go from being a dragon to a human, but it is worth it and it's satisfying. And Eustace gets a joy and a satisfaction and a genuine, I don't even want to say pleasure.
It is really interesting the absolute pain, but there's something satisfying about it at the same time. It's really weird.
Yeah, he said it hurts worse than anything he had ever felt.
And then he's, you know, Aslan throws him into the water, and when he hits the water, it hurts at first, and then it's, you know, wonderful after that.
He's
then
we have another, basically baptized.
Yeah.
I mean, for lack of a better term. I mean,
well, there's definitely the...
He's cleansed. He's
evoking the imagery of baptism here, I think, absolutely.
Yeah, I think he just... I mean, just even going back beyond baptism to some... The basic imagery of being washed and cleaned and cleansed.
And then there's another really dreamlike bit here where Eustace says, and after a bit, the lion took me out and dressed me. And Edmund says, dressed you with his paws? And Eustace says, well, I don't exactly remember that bit. But he did somehow or other in new clothes. And that's another bit that, you know, it's...
This is
that's
where the
one
filmmakers
would
go,
though,
say, I have no idea how we do this, guys. I don't know what to do.
Right. But, and even though, in a second, you know, Edmund says it wasn't a dream. Well, there are the clothes for one thing, and you've been, well, undragoned for another, which is where we get the term undragoned.
Undragoned, yeah.
Edmund said it first. But so I think we're supposed to be left with, no, this wasn't a dream. It was real. Obviously, the end results of it was absolutely real, that he was undragoned.
I've never thought of it as a dream. I mean, I guess you could always, but I've never thought of it like that. I just see it as, you know, go back to anyone's, almost any moments in someone's life that were really, really significant. I mean, I could almost think back to my wedding, and I'm almost thinking more about the emotions and how I felt than the exact sequence of events or who said what and what words, you know?
Okay, so I would ask you this, and I'm not saying I think it's a dream, because you definitely get the feeling that Lewis wants you to think of it as real.
Uh-huh.
Edmund says, no, it wasn't a dream. But it's almost like every time I read the book, I sort of imagine it in my mind as a dream. Then Edmund says it wasn't a dream, and he's like, oh, that's right, it's supposed to be real, because it has such a dreamlike quality to it. So I would ask you this. I totally get what you're saying of, you know, being remembering the emotions of it. But if I had been standing right there watching, like, what would I have seen? Would I have seen what's described here? Would I have seen the skin peeling off? Would I have seen Aslan dress Eustace? Would I have seen Aslan speak? And is that just a question that just shouldn't be asked? Or, I mean, what do you think?
Now I'm going back to the last C.S. Lewis book I finished this morning, actually, which was Perelandra. And Ransom is asking, basically, that one of the... the elder, one of the angels, basically, in the story, about just observing certain things, and they said there's some things that are just as real even if you can't observe them. And they said you can observe a rock in a fixed place, but if someone throws the rock at your eye, what do you see?
Uh-huh.
So you experience it all the more.
Uh-huh.
But just because you experience it all the more doesn't mean you could actually recall what it looked like. And I think I'm just going to say that and kind of leave it at that.
You see, like, when you talk about the scene, you can't help but talk of it in vague, dreamlike terms, even though it supposedly really happened. And I almost wonder if it's, I guess it's sort of somehow both. I don't know.
I mean, even in a dream, okay, why do we call a dream a dream? Do we call a dream because of how it feels, or because it didn't occur?
I dreamed a dream of time gone by.
Seriously, though, why do we call a dream a dream, and why do we say it happened? Like, why is there that juxtaposition? You know, you said maybe it's both. Well, what if we were to take, you know, the experience of the dream and combine it with the fact that it did happen?
Obviously, he was undragoned, and
obviously
all
he wasn't
the character
dragon,
moments
I think,
there.
I think he was actually saw Aslan in front of him and was thrown into the pool. I think you could say maybe it felt like a dream, but...
Please post a comment, listeners, and tell me what you think about this.
Yeah,
was it a dream? Was it real? Could it have been both? I think it definitely feels like Lewis wants us to walk away with it.
When we say it was like... When we say... It was only a dream. We mean it never happened. And
right.
Then
because obviously
we
this
it felt
happened
like
in the
dream,
sense that
where we say we felt.
I just
felt
wonder
like
if maybe
it
what
work,
maybe if I had been
different.
Standing there, what I really would have seen is Eustace asleep, and he would just slowly become. But internally, he's experiencing.
I don't think that's
what
you
he's
would
emerging
have
in his
personally.
Mind is this really painful process.
Yeah, I don't think that. Yeah, I know what you're saying. I don't think that if you were just sitting there in the glade, you know, watching, oh, he's morphing into a human. Oh, he's a human again, but he has clothes all of a sudden. I don't think that's what you would have seen.
I think maybe. I really don't know, and I kind of like not knowing. I think it makes the scene that much more intriguing.
Fair enough.
But and of course, then we talked about this a couple times. We've sort of mentioned this a couple times. I love, of course, the fact that Edmund is there. It would have been very easy for Eustace to come back and just tell the story to the group. And I think initially you don't quite when it's just sort of weird. Like, why is it Edmund? And then it becomes so clear. Lewis even says, let me find it here. You know, Edmund says, you know, you were only an ass, but I was a traitor. Mm-hmm. And so I love that Edmund, of all people, would understand more than the others what Eustace had gone through. And I love Eustace's, he talks about his reaction to the name of Aslan. And Eustace says, I've heard that name mentioned several times since we joined the Dawn Treader, and I felt, I don't know what, I hated it. But I was hating everything then. Of course, Edmund can absolutely relate to that.
Yeah, because Edmund had the exact same response. In the
he felt mysterious horror. You know, Eustace says, who is Aslan? Do you know him? Edmund says, well, he knows me. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Edmund was reluctant to say, I know Aslan. I was like, that's kind of a big statement. Well, he definitely knows me, though. I'll say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that Aslan is just, it's just too big of a character to say, yes, I know him.
Yeah.
And put it in a box that way.
I think the reader feels the same way. You know, because we see we learn something about Aslan in every single book. Mm-hmm. And I love that, you know, the reader can't really say that. Because if you were to say, which character do you feel like you understand the best? Well, to a certain extent, the character we learn the most about is Aslan. But there's a difference between...
But you feel like we only learn 2% about him.
You know, you could read about a person all their life, for years. You could read about all their hobbies. You could get a list of every book they've ever read, movie they've ever watched, play they've ever seen. You could even look at every conversation they've ever had, and you would say you know a lot about them, but could you really say you know them? You know?
Yeah.
And I think it's that same kind of thing here. They are learning a lot about him, and they do know him to an extent, but to say, yeah, I know him, it just seems like a leap because he is so big.
He's always we're always getting the feeling about Aslan that there's a lot more going on than we are seeing or
we
even
feel
understand.
Like we're a small page in his book.
He's
of
off
many
doing
volumes.
Other things.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely.
We feel like that's why you know it's always interesting where the main characters who actually really know him, they're kind of Aslan showed up. What a privilege! You know, it's not like you know. Well, yes, we are doing something that we think is important, but who knows what he's doing? You know,
right, absolutely.
Another, some other world, you know.
Yeah, it's probably the best example I think in the whole series of Lewis making something feel like it's not limited to what's on the page. That there's a lot more. This is just a very small piece of it. Aslan's the picture perfect example of that, I think.
Yeah.
Another little question here that's not answerable, but. They wonder, it says, people wondered whether the other dragon had killed the Lord Octesian several years ago, or whether Octesian himself had been the old dragon. So which, I don't know why I'm even asking, can't answer it. Which do you think it was?
I personally tend to think that it was the Lord Octesian. I guess that's the way that my imagination takes me, but it's not like I'm going to claim I have any more evidence
right,
than someone who holds the opposite opinion. I think it's one of those great things where Lewis doesn't feel, unlike maybe some authors, that he doesn't feel like he has to answer every single little question.
Because even the characters never knew.
Yeah,
if these events really
think,
happened, and Lewis is just presumably getting his information from the real people, well, they didn't know.
You know, you read the history books, you don't know everything in the history books, you know?
It's
like, well, you know, was this guy the... You know, who killed this guy? Well, we don't know for sure, you know. I mean,
but
was this the Lord Octesian?
And it makes
been.
You wonder, like going along that line again. So what was the – it makes you wonder if there was an interesting story that happened here. Because if the other lords obviously left without him at some point, and did they say, oh my gosh, he's been eaten by a dragon, let's get out of here. Or was it he's become a dragon and maybe what was Octesian's – if that happened, what was Octesian's reaction when he found out he was a dragon, if that's the way it happened?
Mm-hmm.
So you almost wonder, could there be another little interesting short story just in that?
Sure. I think there would be.
And I get that sense all throughout the Chronicles of, man, I've Maybe someday I'll tell you how the Lone Islands were conquered,
and maybe I won't. Oh, thanks.
Right. Or in the Silver Cherry teases it by saying, you know, the story of the horse and his boy and Shasta and Bree, and then in the next book we'll actually get the full version of it, of course. And I always thought it was just super epic, I guess. Just super cool. I don't know why. The idea of the arm ring hanging out on the bit of rock and just being there forever. And, you know, Lewis says, you know, for all I know, it is still hanging there, you know, it is hanging there still and will hang there until that world ends.
I have to say, whenever we read the last battle, I always had an image when the earth was, I always had an image of the arm ring finally falling off.
It finally falls, like the rock breaks or something.
Now, I thought about that every single time I went through it.
That's really funny. I don't think I ever thought about that.
I actually did. I thought. You know, at some point, you know, until that's well, that, oh, okay.
After hey, however many ending. Thousand years, it finally fell. So, Eustace has been on Dragon, and through the rest of the story, we're going to see a much improved Eustace. But, Lewis writes, it's not an instantaneous, oh, that's it. He's obviously just a nice guy, and that's it.
It would be nice and fairly true to say that from that time forth, Eustace was a different boy. I love how he puts that in quotes.
Right.
You know, like, you know, typical story writer. To be strictly accurate, he began to be a different boy. He had relapses. And I love that because, you know, people do have life-altering, life-changing experiences and are redeemed, but, you know,
it's not overnight.
It's like a dimmer switch, you know, there's a point of ignition, and then it gradually grows. I find that newer stories, whether it's in literature or movies today, they like to make that redemption point the culmination.
Yeah.
Like that's the end of the story, you know? Mm. And for Lewis, it was far more, you know, in other great authors, I mean, I'm just going to bring up another, we were just discussing it, Les Miserables. The redemption, the musical is about 2.5 hours. The redemption occurs about 30 minutes in.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest of it is how he struggles to make the right decisions, and it's the story from that point forward. You know, even in Perelandra, you know, another Lewis book, the man Ransom is kind of struck by this idea that, well, the angels are basically saying when humanity is redeemed, that's the beginning. You know, mm-hmm. he said, well, we always thought of, you know, the Savior coming to earth, that's the center point in history. They said, no, it's like a man getting out of a boat and having a misstep before he begins his journey. And uh-huh. for them, you know, the ending was the beginning. For Eustace, his real journey is beginning here. And the same for the Friends of Narnia and all the Narnians in the last battle. The real story is beginning there. And that's a perspective and a worldview that C.S. Lewis had that applies here.
And again, I think it also just adds to the idea that Lewis, not only does he not know everything, there are some things that he does know, but is choosing not to include. And he's saying, you know, mm-hmm. there were still many days when he could be very tiresome, but most of those I shall not notice. The cure had begun. So I think because, like, okay, the rest of Eustace's journey is not as essential to this story of the voyage, so I'm not going to include a lot of that. But just so you know, this story went on.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, you kind of get a little bit of a picture in the Silver Chair. You can see where he's almost like, okay, yeah, he's a good guy, but you kind of think, oh, come on, Eustace, why do you have to say that? And you kind of, you know, his journey continues even mm-hmm. through there.
And, of course, the most amazing part of this is having just talked about one of the most memorable, powerful, iconic scenes in the series.
We could go longer.
Well, we could definitely go longer, and we're also only 7 chapters into this, and there's still so much more to go. I mean, this book really just kind of gets weirder and weirder and more fantastical as it goes along, and it's really just beginning. There's still so much more to go, and I'm really looking forward to getting into all that.
Further up and further in.
Further up and further in.